What was that? That was a reorganizing the deck chairs announcement. Was it worth what they spent on it? And I don't know all the cost numbers, but my answer is I doubt it.
The connection between strategy and the narrative. You want to have the strategy, but then you also need to be able to explain it in a way that how do customers react to it? How does Wall Street react to it? How do your employees react to it?
From Orion X, this is the Marketing Podcast. Marketing has transformed in significant ways. More technology, more data, more social, more blending of arts and sciences, more integrated with every other function, and ultimately more critical to the organization. Join Shaheen Khan and Doug Garnett as they discuss news and happenings in the world of marketing, from the boardroom to customer programs.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of the Marketing and Everything Else podcast with Shaheen Khan and Doug Garnett. So we've got ourselves into a routine where we're publishing the last episode when we're recording the next one, which is what's happening today. And today is Friday, June 20th. Doug and I have been on the call for a good couple of hours, I would say. So how are you, Doug?
I'm good. You know, it's Friday afternoon. We had my scotch for the day, so
that's brilliant. And it's a nice drizzle in Portland, Oregon.
Yeah, we got it. You know, it's been really clear weather, getting a little bit hot, and all of a sudden we got drizzle, and it actually rained pretty hard earlier. So,
well, we got to keep it green, so that'll good. Yeah.
Yeah, we like that.
Yeah. So I understand we have a cartoon, and the Oon in the cart, as we like to say?
Well, the Oon in the cart goes back to our one of our favorites, which is the cartoonist Tom Fishburne. And in the cartoon, there's a woman walking away, turns to a guy and says, have you figured out how AI will impact our business? And the guy's on a computer. He says, working on it. And the thought bubble coming up from the computer has a question mark, a prompt, where he's entering, how will AI impact our business? And the AI is responding, there are many ways that AI can impact.
Excellent.
So, yes, how will AI impact our business? Let me ask the AI.
AI is going to tell us how it's going to impact us.
I'm not sure I'm down with this. I think there's some possible risks in that equation.
So I think a major issue with AI, because it is doing some of the thinking and deciding for human beings, mm-hmm. is just exactly how much of that are we going to outsource to AI? And you could argue that it's going to be, I mean, I do actually argue that it's going to be better than humans in many different things. Mm-hmm. And why not do that? On the other hand, there's also a question of if we don't exercise our brain, maybe it'll just turn into, you know, what was it that we used to say? Liquid fabric softener.
Yeah. It could go to mush. And
So well, what do you do?
Well, I think, I mean, as we were talking earlier, to some degree, this is what's happened with every new tech. Every time a new tech comes out, we always have to deal with the fears of what do we lose by adopting the tech. And I think, I don't think the fears are unfounded. I will admit, I spent a lot of my career continuing to do things on calculators by hand. And I'd have people on my staff say, you know, Doug, you could create an Excel spreadsheet. I did them on a calculator because they gave me an instinct for the numbers. So I didn't want to lose that. On the other hand, yeah, they're right. Excel spreadsheets just fine. And I don't have any problem with it. I don't mean to try to be an ancient old curmudgeon, you know, demanding that we not invent, that the horseless carriage not come around.
Right.
But on the other hand, I do think that every new technology, you know, like there's a good and a bad to it. And the bad isn't necessarily worth saying don't go to that. But we always lose a little bit, you know, as we lose some of the stuff around books and going to ebooks. I think people have realized there's some things they lose that are hard to quantify and articulate, but there's things you lose. Is the trade-off worth it? Well, you know, for me, there's a lot of things I still read as ebooks because they're a lot easier to search. They're a lot easier to bookmark, all those kinds of things. On the other hand, there are some things I really love to read as a physical book. And so for me, it's kind of like a bit of both. So I expect AI, we could look at it nicely in that way if the AI shamans would shut their traps and let us just deal with the technology. But I think to some level they're just trying to raise lots of money and get fabulously rich. And so they tell us AI is everything. I'd love to see about a year where we all got to just use it as a tool and have all the hype disappear in the background. So we can discover what's really good about it.
But there's also the disruption factor of new technology mm-hmm. that you know, one of my favorite quotes, when things change, they're not the same anymore, is that it is changing things. And how we react to that change is going to impact us differently. And of course, we see the conversation in social media and such about the impact of AI on the brain, on education, how we cultivate it, how we remain relevant and agile mentally, like, and what is the best way of doing that? Is the best way to use it, or is the best way to not use it?
Well, I think we offer an interesting alternative in that conversation, which is, it came up on Retail Wire in the last 2 weeks. There was a discussion about, well, you know, all you hear in the executive hallways of retailers are discussions about AI. And my response was, what? That doesn't make any sense. You know, AI is an issue. They need to be exploring it. But it better not dominate executive discussions, because executives have so many critical things to deal with in retail. They're really screwing up if AI is the only thing that they're talking about. Yes, it's important. Yes, things are going to come. Yes, there's opportunity. But no, you're not going to really get ahead of the game by discussing it all the time in your discussions in the hallways at Walmart headquarters. That is not worth it. And if you're doing that, you're making a mistake. So it's kind of this funny little, you know, twist. You know what I mean? A twist to it. It's like, yeah, I mean, if you're in an area that's involved with AI, then yeah, you're going to discuss it a lot. If you're doing customer service, how do we integrate it as a chatbot? Do we or don't we? I mean, all this. But if you're at the executive level of Walmart, you've got far bigger fish to fry. And, you know.
Well, I heard a good one. We're all familiar with FOMO, fear of missing out.
Right.
I also heard this one as it relates to AI about FOBO, fear of becoming obsolete.
Yeah, that's true.
So there is definitely that too. And I believe in that context, I can see why the board and senior management would be concerned about it, because they want to make sure that if they're not catching the carrot, they're not going to get hit by the stick either.
Right.
But a lot of that basically boils down to understanding what it is they're talking about.
Yeah.
And that also is problematic, because the whole area is shifting so fast.
Right. How do we know what we're talking about?
Right.
Well, okay, but I'm going to also go a different place with that, which is, what that reminds me of is, oh, they're making the same mistake they made with the internet. Because the internet distracted retail executives from their strength. Because the retail strength is the freaking store. And they got all wrapped up in, we've got to become Amazon. Or we've got to become, you know, so online that we're going to make all our profit in the future online. No, you're not, right? The advantage the retailer has is the store. And if they take their eye off the store at any point in time, they've made a massive strategic mistake. Now, you know, Alistair Thompson, our friend from the UK, observed to me that one of the challenges he sees very often in business is that stock shareholders are not business people, at least not with a sophisticated understanding of how a business really should be run. And so, you know, shareholders really easily become obsessed with stuff like, well, you've got to become internet savvy. Maybe, you know, what happens if we wait a year? Does it really hurt us if we wait a year? Or things like, you know, yes, we do have to worry about that, but our store remains the single most important priority. And shareholders don't like to hear that because they love the shiny baubles. And I think that there's this indirect impact that when shareholders are too obsessed with shiny baubles, then executives become too obsessed with shiny baubles. And it's tough. I don't think the executives are in an easy position, because one of the executive roles is they have to make sure there's enough money flowing in the company. And sometimes that requires investment or borrowing or all those things. And those are all affected by the issue. But if I care about how do I run the company, the issue is the store. And so I think that's maybe one of the tricks with AI has become so dominant that all of the discussion can become about it.
Yeah, but sometimes you get these reality distortion fields, to reference Steve Jobs, and people think, what if this whole thing is about to change in such a massive way that stores don't matter anymore, and we're just going to be left missing the boat? What do we do now? What do we need to do now? You know, so a lot of this to me comes down to risk management, risk mitigation, threat management, non-financial risk, not that can become financial risk later on, technology risk, all of that. So that is a really complex thing.
Well, it is. I think part of what I'm seeing is I don't think enough executives are able to say what matters. And I'm going to use the word matters, right? Because we can go look at risk management, but does it matter at this point in time? Sometimes it does. Very often it doesn't, because executives are trained to always obsess about risk management. Mm-hmm. But what I care about are, where are the things that will make a serious difference for the company? So, for example, here's my new favorite, and this is partly out of what I've been writing about. I've been doing research into Kodak. Well, Kodak did amazing spending on R&D back in the 1980s. And out of that came the 126 film, the little cartridge. I don't know if 126 is right, but it was a small cartridge, you know, a whole new format. And certainly I have the benefit of hindsight. On the other hand, as a marketing guy looking for things that make a difference, they already owned film. They're not going to own a bigger part of film because they came out with that, but they spent a ton of money on it because they had to make it. They had to get it into retail. They had to change. What was that? That was a reorganizing the deck chairs announcement. Was it worth what they spent on it? And I don't know all the cost numbers, but my answer is I doubt it. You know, so if I look at AI, my question is, you know, executives have to be looking at, where does AI significantly matter? And we need to be dabbling. We know that. We've got to be dabbling in it. But, you know, is there a place for Walmart where it's got a dramatic significance? If it makes Walmart customer service slightly better, that's nice. But at what cost? And, you know.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, maybe the place that it can move the needle is software development and the back end. And of course, that's an area that AI is doing some incredibly effective things.
Very good things. Mm-hmm. Well, and if there was a way that it actually would help with the making sure you have products in stock in every store, in the stores, you know, that's a really ugly, nasty challenge, and it directly affects a retailer's revenues. That might be where it would really help, if you could figure it out. And I don't know.
If you can figure it out.
And I don't know what the scoop is on it, but I guess I go there because that's really one of the things that bothers me, is I think we've become dominated by the hype around it, but every company has got to sit back and say, wait a minute, what matters to me? And if you're as big as Walmart, you better be spending a bunch of money exploring what it does.
Now, what if you're Starbucks and not Walmart? What matters then?
Well, first of all, you should be dabbling in it. But what really matters at Starbucks are your baristas.
So let's switch to Starbucks, because we were discussing it massively.
Absolutely.
I mean, we have been discussing it since forever, but also since their new CEO was appointed, and we both liked that appointment. We thought the background and the profile was good, and the initial steps, I liked every one of them. So I've become like a fan of the new management, and they just announced some new things that I also like. So I'm maybe biased a little bit, but let's chat about it.
Well, absolutely. And I am too, because with the new CEO, as we talked earlier, my only concern with the new CEO is he had come from an engineering background and had done some tech stuff at Chipotle. And so for me, those were question marks, not red flags, but question marks. Like, will he become obsessed with the tech, you know, some sort of quick tech fix, or will he deal with the serious issues, which are people? And the answer is, and I'm very pleased to say, people. They had a big event recently, and we have a Financial Times article about it, where they brought together 14,000 store managers and flew them into Vegas for a big meeting. And he stood up and promised more employees to their stores, because that's been one of the very major complaints. Employee quotes all over just talk about how there's, you know, they're demanded to be friendly and nice and cheerful and upbeat, and then not given enough people for them to be able to be, you know, cheery and upbeat. And so he came out and made a bunch of big announcements. They're making a big investment in human capital. And they've got a program they're calling the Green Apron Program, warm, kind interaction with the customers. Average employees per store had dropped over the last 5 or 6 years from 23 to 18 or 19. That's a 20% drop in employees in stores. That's a bad sign when you're a people-based company.
And they had difficulty hiring, too. So could be that, but yes.
Well, and, you know, and they're having difficulty hiring because so many baristas were telling these horror stories about reprimands, about all kinds of stuff that is just bad management. I mean, fundamentally bad management of people. So anyway, he announced that they're going to start hiring more employees. They're going to put a lot of emphasis on trying to figure out how to balance the three different types of orders they get in the store, which I think has been a very significant problem. I think they're beginning a lot of that.
Now, by three ways, you mean online, in-person, drive-through?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay.
Now, I've focused a lot on the drive-through metrics because they put big metrics in place for drive-through and they had punishments, you know, for stores. Now, at my Starbucks I go to regularly, it's all of a sudden we've had a wonderful change. The lines have gone down at the drive-through. So something's happened that they're getting more people through, which might be reducing their menu. That may have helped a lot. But anyway, I really haven't had a long line at the drive-through for a while. And at the same time, the staff seem a lot happier, and they don't seem like they're fussing about either the metrics for drive-through or the arbitrary demand that they have to say something nice, which used to be there. And I've heard that from quite a few former Starbucks employees. On the other hand, my wife went to one in across the river in Washington State, and she said the barista was almost in tears because they were under so much pressure for drive-through time.
Meat quota.
So, meat quota, basically. They still, so apparently it's not everywhere, but at least at my store, it seems like they've made progress.
Right. I see improvements in the one I go to as well. Mm-hmm. In-store services seems to be faster. Mm-hmm. They have a new machine that creates one cup of actual normal coffee, not espresso, which is normally what I have. And because it does one cup at a time and pretty fast, it also allows them to have more of a variety because now any bean is available. You don't have to worry about whatever was brewed recently and then ask which one is the freshest because they're all right on the spot. And it's kind of like an accelerated French press, it seems to me, because it pours out pretty fast when it goes, but it grinds and it kind of does. Anyway, you have that and the lines have been like pretty fast.
Judith and I are both loving the fact that they actually have new ice machines too. And the ice is gorgeous. Makes these little kind of M&M, peanut M&M sized pills of ice. Well, and I know that's a funny thing to obsess about, but Judith grew up in a family of refrigeration. So her dad repaired Safeway refrigerators and knew a lot about ice machines. So she grew up with an ice machine in the house. And it's an interesting tidbit to watch because it's significant. You know, how they get their ice matters. And this new ice is really lovely. So that's good. I think there are a few other things. They're going to add a full-time assistant store managers for the big locations, which is most of them, and, a bunch of that stuff. There were complaints, of course, from investors, so maybe we ought to talk about those investors, those pesky investors.
Well, I think it goes back to what matters. Mm-hmm. And I think, at least in this podcast, there's consensus that baristas and quality of coffee, those are it, you know? I also think that for them to be the so-called third place is still a thing. And I see really every Starbucks I go to is pretty packed. People are there sitting for a good while, right?
Well, and I love that somebody made a comment in this article about, people are all working from home and, you know, all that stuff. I don't know, but when I go to coffee shops, they're primarily a place of people working on their computers. And I see a lot of Zoom calls happening in the coffee shops.
Yep, exactly.
All that. And as you noted, you know, if you're in a neighborhood and you're working from home, nothing better than an hour break to walk around the neighborhood, go get your coffee, sit and have a drink, and maybe even bring your computer with you. So I think that the world's a lot more varied than sometimes curmudgeonly investors can recognize, to be honest.
Yes, really. Yeah. And also, you were saying, we were talking about just the history of Starbucks and how they really created this market.
Yeah.
To the point that we can't be sure the market would have been created anyway. Mm-hmm. It wasn't that kind of a market.
No, I think, you know, what I've written for the book, I've done a lot of deep dive around Starbucks. It's been quite fun. And I've been surprised and learned a lot about them. You know, for history, in 1994 or 5, I can't remember which, I presented to Howard Schultz and the executive committee about an idea for an ad campaign. And I was the business guy, so I had run numbers and worked on projections to say, okay, well, if you did this, this is what you get. And Howard Schultz wisely said, we're not doing that because those numbers aren't good enough. So being the guy that I am, I wasn't about to try to invent numbers to make him happy. And so he made the right choice. But yeah, I've been here, and they've just, it's an incredible interactive thing, because before Starbucks, there was no espresso market. After Starbucks, there's this massive espresso market.
Just ignited.
Yeah. Now, I've talked to a lot of people who are more kind of economist, kind of rough, and they'll say, oh, they just duplicated stores. Oh, it was only, no, they didn't. I mean, yes, they duplicated stores and that, you know, but they had to decide what to duplicate. And that was an interactive investigation that went on at least for, in major ways, for at least 10 years, and or if not more. And they still explore, how does this store need to be? What goods should be in it? How do people interact? And, you know, I was saying earlier, I mean, actually, in a lot of ways, thinking of a coffee shop, just one of them, it's an incredibly incredible example of complexity in business.
Yeah.
Because you have all these elements. Let's just pick a few. Coffee, the people who work there, the neighborhood around it, the style you put it up in, the location it's in, the furniture you have. You have decisions in all, and the food that goes with the coffee. You have decisions in all those areas. Traditional kind of managerial approach would say, well, we make each one perfect. We have the best coffee. Well, I know people, I'm very close friends with people that own coffee shops, and the answer is no, that's the wrong answer. You know, what makes a coffee shop thrive in a neighborhood is all the right things that work in that neighborhood, so that people in the neighborhood go, I got to go to the coffee shop.
Yeah.
You know, and what about the food? Well, the coffee shop I go to, the food's not glorious, but it's really good. And so I go up there and almost daily, and I get myself a lunch, and it's just great. You know, for me,
you're absolutely right. Actually, the quality of the pastries is what draws me to any coffee shop.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, you know, they make sandwiches. They're okay. Their pastries rock. They have a bunch of really good. So there's like all these moving parts, and you can't arbitrarily say this is the mix of moving parts that makes a start, that makes a coffee shop successful. And that's a really that's true in every business, but it's super evident once you get to coffee shops. Because so I know coffee. What's it? Go ahead.
We were talking about this, that you introduce better quality coffee, espresso-based coffee, and you figure out what that market is, and now you've ignited this evolution. But maybe what you ignited is going to want to have more now that they know what they want. So you go through a period where the baseline is like what everybody wants. And that's true. I think we did go through a period where if you just had an espresso or a latte, you were in business.
Yeah, or a latte and a mocha. If you have, you know, espresso, latte, and mocha, wow, that really is good.
You're in business, right? But then what if you want more? What if you now want it to be this way and that way? So is this the kind of a market that increasingly wants to be just so for each customer?
It just, well, I think there's it's a few things. I think some of it is that, but some of it is, you know, key in the idea of complexity is that everything's always adapting. And so the minute you open and come out with a latte, people start changing and they say, oh, God, that's really great. Well, over time, their response to a latte is going to change, right? Because you get used to it.
Right.
And so for a period of time, you're like, oh, that's great. And then you're like,
it becomes
really
a new floor. Yeah.
And then you start going, yeah, but you know, I kind of want something a little different. And so then you say, well, what about a macchiato or a cappuccino or, you know, whatever that is. And so there's kind of always a need for a certain freshness. And I think there's two things going on there. One is there's always some need for something fresh so that people remain excited about it. And part of Starbucks management has been to keep the stores fresh, keep the goods fresh, keep the, you know, how many new things do you introduce on the bakery menu in a year? I don't know what the answer is, but you got to make decisions like that and kind of get a feel for what's going to work for maintaining a healthy relationship with the customer. And there's a lot of moving parts to that. Then you've got cultural shifts that start happening. So that you get things like matcha comes in. Oh, all of a sudden but something else gets popular. You have to decide, do I touch that or do I leave that for other people? You know, what about iced drinks? Well, you know, they did really well with Frappuccinos, and they have some really great kind of different iced drinks like that. But up here in Oregon, Dutch Brothers seems to dominate the quirky ice drink market. You know, that seems to be, from what I can tell, their real claim to fame. And they make a lot of money off of it. And when I went public, and they're doing really well with it. Partly, I think that there's a lot of room. Human tastes are so widely varied. There's a lot of room for different people to do different things with coffee, and for Starbucks to continue to be at the core as the reliable one that I go to when I'm on travel, because I know what I'm going to get.
Yeah.
And I think it's a mixture of those two. Mm. New things can always be coming up, but Starbucks should be able to be managed where it doesn't go away.
So definitely agree that you cannot just say it's the beverage market and therefore I can play in every segment of it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. There are some distinct areas and you're, if you're in coffee, then the adjacent markets are what you have and not more. But the other thing was how you present this, because we talked about how a focus on baristas means more cost for labor costs, especially as you ramp up. And how do you communicate that to investors, Wall Street, because they're counting every penny? So I see this, the connection between strategy and the narrative. Mm-hmm. You want to have the strategy, but then you also need to be able to explain it in a way that isn't misleading, but it also carries you through. How do customers react to it? How does Wall Street react to it? How do your employees react to it?
If we take Wall Street, it's interesting to compare what they're doing now. So first of all, Wall Street's concerned by the costs. So there's one guy that's worried that their costs will rise to $9.6 billion next year and $10.2 billion the year after. There's somebody else that says there's $1 billion in more spending coming. The one guy that's worried, talked about how much it's going to go up there, is worried. The person who said, it's probably going to go up by $1 billion, said, it's what you got to do. I think there's a balance of them. But it's interesting to me to compare this with the last CEO left behind a project that Howard Schultz introduced, which was, what was it called? It was an equipment-based called the Siren Craft System. And it cost $500,000 per store. And one of the really quirky things I think about investors is $500,000 per store in high-tech equipment making coffee, they don't bat much of an eye at. But if you're looking at 4 or 5 more people per store on average, you're looking at maybe $200,000 per store,
right?
Not $500,000. I mean, this is a lot cheaper than the Siren Craft system that they didn't really bitch about. But because it's people, investors have, I don't know, I mean, agree with me or not on this one, see what you think. But over the last 50 years, concerns about waste and things have ended up focused very heavily on staffing size.
Right.
And investors become obsessed with numbers of people.
There is, the thing is that when you put these in spreadsheets, you say, I'm going to have a $500,000 equipment in a store, but not every year. I'm going to have it for, and then I'm going to have this much maintenance, and then I'm going to depreciate it. And then I'm going to run it for another year after that. And then I'm going to replace it. So the spreadsheet looks very different than if you say, I'm going to add 4 or 5
annual 160,000,
right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then there's turnover, there's training, there is this, that, and the other. So I think that's one reason that is on the face of it is kind of reality. But I also think that, like you were saying in our pre-call, that how much are you paying without counting because you don't have enough people?
Yeah, I think
how much business are you losing? How much goodwill are you losing? How much productivity you're losing?
Howard Schultz writes about the early days when he established a very generous generous benefits package for baristas. And that what happened, one of the side effects with that was that their turnover rate was only 60% when the retail average was 150 to 200%. Just think of the cost savings from having a lower turnover rate like that.
Absolutely.
Not having to train people, not having to search for people, my God. And then the benefit to customers of more people they know that have stayed around the store. Those kinds of things have tremendous benefit for you. It's tricky because it's really easy to add up the costs of all these employees. It's much harder to trust in or even add up the unexpected benefits. I think when he did that, he observed that he needed baristas, in a sense, to represent the coffee to customers.
Right.
So they
right.
learned about it. Well, I call that a billion tiny customer interactions. And the value of a billion tiny customer interactions is immense.
That's true.
That's right. But you can't measure each one. And right. so people hate that. You know, it's the old way of doing business. Well, if I can't measure it, then I can't manage right. it. Yeah, you can. You better. Because most things that matter can't be measured.
Well, it's wonderful that we are ending with data, as we obviously must do.
Well, of course.
Because, you know, here's once again a situation where the data doesn't show up when it's supposed to, or mm-hmm. it's hard to collect, or blah, blah, blah. And
yeah.
it doesn't, therefore, you don't have the full picture.
So. And you still have to make management decisions anyway. You know, and that's what's have, really that's tricky right. about it is you know, yeah. So you don't have the data. What do? Well, you don't just wait for it to come in. You still have to yeah. make choices.
I used to say that when you ask for data, it's because you don't have the expertise. Like mm-hmm. imagine you get a meeting with Einstein. You don't say, show me the data, mm-hmm. right? Like the entire reason you want a meeting with him, mm-hmm. so you don't have to talk about data. You mm-hmm. want his interpretation of whatever mm-hmm. data he got. So, you know, expertise is something else, you know. Uh-huh.
You know, I was going to say that, you know, you're in good company with that opinion because Edwards Deming observed that he thought management by metrics was basically management of not knowing what to do.
That's and, right.
that people choose to use metrics because it's a way to avoid actually having to manage.
Thinking, yeah. Well, that's a good full circle to AI because
there you go.
We do not need AI to not be thinking. That can happen even without AI.
Reminds me of this is what Don McDougall said about Alan Charlesworth years ago, which was, you know, you have to track along, but you know what? He always wraps up every loop. So we just figured out how to close all the loops.
Both of them are awesome. Yeah. although I have not talked to them in a while, but
yeah. mm-hmm.
All right. Very good. Any parting comments before we wrap up this one?
Well, I'm going to just raise the one comment, which is if you want to, there's yet another scandal at Cannes in the ad awards with a submission that won a Grand Prix being considered for whether it doctored the information it submitted. You know, when awards become so prestigious, they become somewhat invalid because they become a thing to be gamed. You know, ad agent, somebody feels like they're going to make their name because they got a Grand Prix award at Cannes. Yeah. Yeah, they're off to do whatever wow. it takes. Anyway, there's another one. I mean, I don't know what will happen. We'll see what sorts out on it. But
well, you know, further evidence of my saying that all systems shall be gamed mm-hmm. once you let it sit there for a while.
Yeah, especially if that system contributes to whether you're in business or not, it will be gamed by somebody.
You know? That's right. If you set it up so that that becomes too much of a litmus test, mm-hmm. then you provide the incentives for it, and then that's just going to happen.
Yeah, you ensure that it will begin.
Well, anyway, on that note, thank you all for being here. Thank you, Doug.
Thank you, Shaheen.
Until next time, take care.
That's it for this episode of The Marketing Podcast. Every episode is posted on orionx.net and shared on social media. Use the comments section or tweet us with any questions or to propose topics. If you like the show, rate and review it on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. The Marketing Podcast is a production of Orion X. Thank you for listening.